This week is the last week you can sign up for these. These are the leather-bound editions of the Heidelberg Catechism, which we are going to place an order for. We have found out that Cumberland Valley Bookstore in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, is offering these at $10.20 plus tax, which is less than what we originally thought. So if you want one, there is a sign-up sheet in the narthex, and you can sign up and tell us how many copies, and we should get them in a week or so. But I highly encourage you to secure one of these and keep it in your purse or on your person and go through the catechism with us. Now, this morning, we're looking at a variety of texts that address the subject of moral inability and moral obligation. And I'm going to begin by reading three passages of Scripture. The first one is found in Matthew's Gospel, chapter 12, beginning with verse 33. A tree is known by its fruits, is the heading in our ESV Bible. And Jesus says this: either make the tree good and its fruits good, or make the tree bad and its fruits bad, for the tree is known by its fruit. You brood of vipers, how can you speak good when you are evil? For out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. The good person out of his good treasure brings forth good. The evil person out of his evil treasure brings forth evil. I tell you, on the day of judgment, people will give an account for every careless word they speak. For by your words you will be justified, and by your words you will be condemned. And then in Paul's epistle to the Romans, chapter 8, beginning with verse 7. For the mind that is set on the flesh is hostile to God, for it does not submit to God's law. Indeed, it cannot. Those who are in the flesh cannot please God. And then finally, a well-known passage in another of the Pauline epistles, chapter 2 of the epistle Paul to the Ephesians. He writes in verse 1, and you were dead in the trespasses and sins in which you once walked, following the course of this world, following the prince of the power of the air, the spirit that is now at work in the sons of disobedience, among whom we all once lived in the passions of our flesh, carrying out the desires of the body and the mind, and were by nature children of wrath like the rest of mankind. We highlighted when we began looking at the first question of the Heidelberg Catechism that the language that it chooses is done very carefully. For example, in question number 1, we understood the word only comfort, not just a comfort or even a supreme comfort, but what is your only comfort? And likewise here in question 5, let me read to you again the language that is used here. Can thou keepest all these things, what things? The law of God, perfectly. Answer. In no wise, for I am prone by nature to hate God and my neighbor. Notice the emphasis there on perfectly. Not, I can do a pretty good job of this. You may remember back when Bill Clinton got caught in the embarrassing situation with Monica Lewinsky. And his good friend Jesse Jackson came to his rescue saying, well, he broke one of the 9, he kept the others. Oh, mercy. Are you serious? He did a pretty good job. He kept 9 of the 10 as if he had actually done that. No. What is it that if you break one of the commandments, what have you done? You broke them all. So there's no bell curve here. Right? God is not grading on the bell. I used to have, when I was teaching college, we'd have a particularly hard course. And at the end of the exam, I would notice that a high percentage of the students did really average or below. And so I'd have to calibrate, you know, because the test was actually too hard. I should have had this many A's, this many B's. But so I'm going to grade on the bell curve. So I will give the people who made the highest grade, which was normally a C+, I will bump them up and go all the way down the line. That's called grading on the bell curve. God does not do that. Are you able to keep these things perfectly? To which the catechism says, no. Why? Here's the answer. I am prone. My nature as a child of Adam is one of total depravity. Now, that is a term that many people take offense at because it gives the impression that we're all as bad as we possibly could be. You know, we all come across this ICSI over there in Iraq. These are barbarians. Forget any kind of political correctness. These are barbarians. And so you could use the word total depravity and say these people are at the bottom of the list. They are capable of atrocities that we can't even begin to imagine. But that's what total depravity means in the Calvinistic system. It's referring to the degree to which sin has affected us. Notice how Paul said in Ephesians, we carried out the desires not only the fleshly and in the body, but in the mind. This is a theological category in which we talk about the noetic effects of the fall. Noetic coming from the word mind. In Romans 8:7, the Apostle Paul says that the mind of the flesh, the mind is set on the things of the flesh, and therefore it is hostile to God. It lacks the ability. And in the Greek text, the word ability is from which you get the word, this Greek word dunamis. We get the English word dynamite. You may remember a couple of years ago we had a guy that got up here and I thought made a rather silly statement. He took the English word dynamite and read it back into the Greek word. You all know that when the Nobel Peace Prize is awarded to people yearly, and that he acclaimed his fame by developing dynamite. And he had a good friend who was a Greek scholar, and he was trying to think of a word for this explosive. So he said to his friend, what's the Greek word for power? The guy said, it's dunamis. So they took and made that dynamite. And so our speaker said, we need to be throwing holy hand grenades at our pagan neighbors. Well, the Greek word doesn't contain the notion of explosion. It refers to the ability, power, to perform some duty. And so Paul says here, the mind that is set on the flesh cannot please. It lacks the ability. Why? Because as a result of Adam's fall. Now, many of you are familiar with the great church father Augustine, and you have read his great book on Confessions. And it was in that book that he developed the notion that he was not talking in an abstract theological sense. He was talking about what he had experienced. He said, I am not able not to sin. Now, he was talking as a Christian. And he used the Latin expression, this is all easy. Some of you have heard it, non posse, non vicari. Not able, the word possible comes out at a Latin word, posse. And picari, we get the word peccadillo from that. He says, I am not able not to sin. Now, what he was saying was, I lack the ability, even as a regenerate man, to restrain my fallen nature. And as a result of this, he developed the fact that Adam and Eve, when they were in the garden, had the ability not to sin. They were posse picari or posse non picari. They were in a position where they were free from sin, but not completely capable of not sinning. That is something that's only reserved for those who are in the redeemed state. That's something we look forward to, that one day in heaven, we will be non-posse picari, not able to sin in any way, shape, form, or fashion. That's one reason when Paul says, the eye hath not seen, the ear hath heard, nor did it enter in the heart of man, the things God hath prepared for them. It's not just talking about walking the golden streets and seeing all the pearly gates and all the things that our imaginations run wild with. You know, we think of heaven as that kind of a place. It's being able not to sin, being free from disobeying God in any way, shape, form, or fashion. Augustine says that's reserved only for the saints. Adam and Eve had the ability to sin, and they did. As a result of their sin, we are non posse, non peccari. But even in our regenerate state, sin is still a reality. The thing we read from the Salvary Declaration, where God allows His own children to see their manifold corruptions in their heart. And it's a frightening thing to see sin as it really is. You know, we oftentimes play the part of the hypocrite. You know, that is in the Greek plays, it was referring to a person wearing a mask. And you've seen these things. Remember the old I Love Lucy, and they'd have a mask of a frowning face and a smiling face, the cinema arts, and it was referring to acting. And we play the part of the hypocrite all too often, even to ourselves, that we do not see the degree to which sin has affected us in our hearts. And so the Catechism says, I am prone by nature to hate God. Now, you say, I don't hate God. You know, we had that quote from J.C. Ryle. You talk to your unbelieving neighbor and it doesn't have any effect on them. They don't see it. That's because all of our own eloquence, all of our own force of art cannot convert people. Now, God does use that instrumentally, but it takes the power of the living God to quicken people who were dead in trespasses. And that word dead means unable to respond to the things of God. The natural man cannot please God. He's unable to. We're going to tell the story at the beginning of the sermon, but I'll use it now. My professor of theology at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School was the late S. Lewis Johnson. And he often told this story where he would occasionally be asked to speak in a church. He was a seminary professor, but he was also on pastoral staff at Believer's Chapel. But when he was up at Trinity, churches from around the area would say, Dr. Johnson, could you come and preach Sunday? And could you, on this one occasion, the pastor, who was one of his students, said, Dr. Johnson, could you come to my church and preach an expository sermon on, you know, the Gospel of John? And could you speak to the adult Bible class? And, oh, by the way, could you give them something practical? You know, don't give them a big dose of theology because it'll just go right over the top of their head. So give them something practical. Well, he didn't know who he was talking to. And so sure enough, he showed up that Sunday morning and the adult Bible class showed up about 85 to 100 people. And he proceeded to speak on the theological distinction between moral inability and moral obligation. And the pastor was just horrified because he went into all the distinctions that I was alluding to with Augustine and how. Afterwards, the class almost unanimously told the pastor, how come you don't teach us this stuff? They wanted to hear about this. And, you know, Dr. Johnson said, it's amazing. The pastors think their people can't understand the difficult theological songs, and they want to. You know, we have this well-known pastor out in Southern California who did a series of sermons on the diet of Daniel. What? And how if we followed the diet that Daniel and his three friends ate, we'd have healthy bodies. And he said the congregation was just really revved up. Here's something that's practical. We can get our hands around a diet. And not to be outdone, another pastor in Northern California decided he would do a study on how all the oils referred to in the Bible could be used as the kind of bath oil that the Queen of Sheba used, or King Hezekiah. And so here we have something practical. What kind of oil should we put in the water? What kind of diet should we eat? And yet he said, our unbelieving neighbors were like, hey, this sounds good. I think I'll go here. What kind of diet I should go on? But talk to them about their inevitable death, about the certainty of becoming before the living God and to be judged. I don't hear that. They have two responses. One is one of indifferent or hostility. Because notice that Paul says, the mind that is set on the flesh, that is the natural man, he has no appetite for these things. No interest at all. Because just as the Catechism teaches us, we are prone not to love the living God. We are prone to idolatry. That is the capacity of the human heart to create an idol that they make. Calvin famously said that the human heart is an idol factory. That all it does is, and you look at this religion in the Middle East, it is a religion of demons. I say that without any apology. This is not a religion that originated from heaven. It is a religion that originated in the pit. It is a vile religion. It is a religion that exalts man's capacity for cruelty. But you confront a person who has no interest in the things of God, and so they will say, well, look at that. That's like one famous scientist, you know, said, science teaches us how to fly to the moon. Religion teaches us how to fly airplanes into buildings. Well, no, not all religions, just that one. But Christianity does say that human mankind, is fallen. And as a result of the fall into sin, they are unable to please God. But this is one thing that I want to close with. Can we stop sinning while we're on earth? And the answer is no. But that does not mean that we're not told, for example, in Colossians 3:1, set your affections on things above. You see, as a result of the fall, the will is in bondage to a fallen nature. It makes choices, to be sure, but the choices are one that it likes, because the affections are likewise. This is a subtle nuance that people oftentimes ignore when we're discussing the question, do we have a free will? Listen, free will in the absolute sense of the word is possessed by but one being. God is free to do whatever he wishes at any time he wants, except he cannot contradict himself. God cannot lie. God cannot deny himself. God is free in the ultimate sense is that his nature as such is not subject to any outside force or internal struggle. But man, as a creature, has no such freedom. For example, you did not choose the time in which you were born. You did not choose the place. You did not choose your family. There's a lot of things that you look around and say, I had no choice in the matter. I was born here to these particular people at this particular time in this particular place. There was no freedom involved in it at all. And as a result of that, our wills, even as Christians, find an ongoing struggle with the remaining residue or the remnants of sin. This is what the Bible talks about when Paul talks about, I find that when I want to do good, there is ever evil present with me. Or the writer to the Hebrews says, let us run the race. The race is to be run, but there is this things that encumber us from running. And so we're supposed to do what? Looking unto Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith. The great Puritan John Owen said in his book on the mortification of sin, in the final analysis, it's not so much what you avoid that is the key to your spiritual life, but what you pursue. Now, you make a list up of things not to do, you know, and I grew up in an environment where there were social taboos, you know, tobacco, alcohol, going to movie, playing cards. You know, they were all associated with vices. So if you were a spiritual Christian, you didn't do that. And I can remember, you know, there's around every city, there's a particular location where there is a population of people who don't do any of those things. It's called a cemetery. They're dead. And they don't do any of those things, but they are not living. And we do not grow in grace simply by avoiding things. Now, we are told to avoid things. In that same chapter, Colossians 3, where the apostle says, set your affections on things above, tells us, put to death the deeds of the body. That is, do not give them life. But in this life, the catechism is underscoring the fact that the law of God is still a reflection of the character of God. It is a mirror. It is designed to show us our incapacities, but it's also a means of prodding us in our obedience. I'm convinced that if anybody claims that he is capable of not sinning, many of you remember Bill Bright, the founder of Campus Crusade for Christ. He's now with the Lord. He once said that he wrote a little booklet. Remember the four spiritual laws? There was a whole series of these things. I know when I was in college, the Campus Crusade for Christ, people handed these out to us and we read them. And How to Breathe Spiritually was one of the little pamphlets. Some of you may have read it. He said he had found that if he followed these principles, he could go 3 or 4 months without sinning. What? What? And it prompted me to remember the words of Anselm to his student whose name was Bozo. Bozo was much like Bill Bright. And Anselm's response when he said, I think I can go quite a while without sinning. Anselm says, you have not considered seriously enough what sin is. You see, if we only look at sin as external things and not motives and inclinations and these things that swarm up in our hearts, the great evangelist D.L. Moody once said famously, he said, the worst person I have ever had to deal with is myself. That's a rather transcendent moment, don't you think, when you finally realize the corruption that lays within you. This is what the Salvor is dealing with, that we see sin as something that is a part of our fabric. So if anyone ever says they can do that, I'm always reminded of what the Apostle John says. If we say we have no sin, we deceive who? Not of anybody else. We deceive ourselves. I had a person one time told me that they had gone 3 weeks without sinning. I said, let me talk to your wife. Talk to those who live in close proximity with you. Find out real quick that that's an illusion. So if the devil confronts me with my long list of sins, Luther said famously, I will say, wait a minute, you forgot these. I will tell to him that, yes, I have sinned in word, thought, and deed. And every day my sin is like the skin that is upon my back. But I have placed my trust in my Savior, who has taken away my sin and condemnation, so that I can say there is now, therefore, no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. See, the reality is the Bible tells us who we are and what we are. And even as Christians, we're reminded ever again with the Apostle Paul, O wretched man that I am, who will deliver me from this body of death? As Christians, we're called to fight a fight, to run a race, and to be ever mindful of the fact that there is presence with me, not just an external adversary, but one that resides within my heart. This is why we have the need for the means of grace on a daily basis. This is why we have to come ever anew to the Lord's table to remember the price that was paid for our redemption. As the elders and deacons do that now, would you be prepared to remember?